Welcome back to the Battle of Stalingrad podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 24 and the continuation of the Red Army's counterattack codenamed Operation Uranus, which was launched on the morning of 19th November 1942. The German 6th Army was facing six Russian armies in an attack that took the Germans by surprise. The Romanians were not as surprised because they'd been warning General Paulus and OKW headquarters about signs of the build-up for weeks. And we know that Luftwaffe General von Richthofen had also reported on the signs, but Paulus and Hitler seemed to be of the opinion that whatever it was, the signs of tanks and infantry building up across the Don to the northwest of Stalingrad would not be significant. The Germans had no idea that General Zhukov's plan was far more audacious than the usual Russian winter offensive. Zhukov planned to encircle the 6th Army and trap them inside Stalingrad. As we heard last episode, the Don Army Group under Rokossovsky burst through the Romanians, while the Southwest Army Group under Vatutin struck out towards Kalach. And then, on the 20th, the Stalingrad Army Group under Yaramenko, which had crossed the Volga in small groups, launched the left horn of the operation and headed northeast towards Kalach. This means that the three Russian fronts, the North Southwest Army Group and Stalingrad Army Group, had over 1 million men against a similar number of Germans, Italians and Romanians, along with other Axis battalions. The Russians now had 900 tanks against the German 700, many of which were unserviceable. Zhukov had gathered 13,000 guns against Paulus's 10,000 and about 1,100 planes against von Richthofen's 1,200. But the real story was where the main blows fell. There, the Russians had overwhelming superiority. Morale amongst the Russians was very good, not so the Germans. The German command, and in particular Hitler, were so obsessed with the prestige problem of capturing Stalingrad that they did not give sufficient attention to consolidating the two flanks of what we conveniently call a salient. Strictly speaking, the 6th Army was defending two fronts rather than a proper salient, particularly the south, where there was a vast kind of no man's land running through the Kalmuck steppe all the way to the northern Caucasus. Romanians had fought well in the attacks in the Crimea and Odessa, but further west, the Italian troops were in a bad way before Operation Uranus began. Their morale was at rock bottom as their homeland came under increased attack by the British and the Americans. The 4th Panzer Army, 60 miles away to the southeast, heard the massive bombardment that signaled the start of Operation Uranus on the 19th November. Then, on the 20th, a freezing milky mist drifted across the south of Stalingrad, and Yeremenko delayed the start of the southern pincer attack. He held off the artillery barrage despite nervous phone calls from Stalin in Moscow. Finally, at 10 a.m., the artillery and Katyusha regiments opened fire. 3/4 of an hour later, and south of Bekitovka, the ground forces moved forward into the channels through minefields cleared by sappers during the night. There, the Russian 64th and 57th Armies supported the thrust by the 13th Motorized Corps. 25 miles further south, along Lake Sarpa and Lake Tsatsa, the 4th Mechanized and the 4th Cavalry Corps led the 51st Army as they headed towards the Romanian southern lines. They slammed into the 20th Romanian Infantry Division, where the neighboring German commanders reported, "Masses of Soviet tanks and waves of infantry in quantities never seen before, advancing at speed." The Romanians were led by Colonel Gross, who had served in the Austro-Hungarian army and spoke good German. Gross's men had only a single 37mm horse-drawn pack gun, which the Russians referred to as the door knocker, as I explained, because its shells simply bounced off the T-34 tank. This was the only piece of artillery in the entire sector, just one gun, but the Romanian peasant soldiers defended bravely. German reports had spoken of how the Romanian officers and NCOs spent their time away from the front lines with prostitutes, alcohol and music, but the rank-and-file soldier was tougher than their leaders. Russian reports at the start of this southern drive spoke of the masses of artillery and vast groups of Romanians, but they were just wrong. There was virtually no artillery, and the Romanians were spread very thin. It was just how effectively the Romanians fought. Much has been written by the Germans later of how the Romanian army collapsed immediately. This is not true. "The Romanians fought bravely, but against the waves of Soviet attack, they had no chance of resisting for long," reported one German officer on the day. The Russians advanced as though they were on the training ground. Fire, move, fire, move. What ill-led army can face such organized mobilization? However, there were deficiencies in the Southern Army. The crossing of the Volga and surrounding streams had been difficult, and supplies had been left behind. By the 21st November, some of Yeremenko's divisions began to run out of food. By the 22nd, the 157th Rifle Division had neither meat nor bread. To resolve these problems, all vehicles in the 64th Army, including those being used as ambulances, were switched to reprovisioning the advance. The wounded were simply left lying in the snow. It's not something the Russians are proud of. And yet, the troops were highly motivated. The hour had come to make the enemy's blood flow for the blood of their wives, children, and fellow soldiers, as the propaganda leaflet said. For many involved in Operation Uranus, it was to be the happiest day of the whole war, including even the final German surrender in Berlin. The Romanians eventually wilted as the Red Army breakthrough was achieved. Thousands of prisoners were shot out of hand by Russian soldiers seeking revenge. Sometimes they would simply fire into the groups meandering across the snow in bursts, only to be stopped by the officers. Then they would start again. The same fate befell the Germans, who began to surrender too. Although the breakthrough was achieved rapidly, the attack did not go according to plan. There were cases of chaos in the leading units, contradictory orders, and at times friendly fire incidents. Major General Volsky's 4th Mechanized Corps became mixed up as they advanced westwards from the line of lakes. Colonel Tonas Sichachin's 13th Motorized Corps ran out of lorries to keep the infantry advancing at the same rate as the T-34s. Then he had a much bigger problem. His divisions ran up against the only Germans in the sector, General Leiser's 29th Motorized Infantry Division. The Germans had seized the initiative and actually advanced on the Russians, believing attack to be the best form of defense. Paulus had ordered Leiser to join General Heim's 48th Panzer Corps west of the Don, and as they moved in the thick mist, they rolled into the right flank of the Russian 57th Army. The counterattack stunned the Russians. Both sides suffered sharp losses as the first tanks opened fire, and when mounted infantry clashed, the full battle was joined. The fog lifted, and the Germans saw a Soviet armored train passing to the west. Behind it, several other freight trains had stopped to disgorge Red Army foot soldiers. Panzers sighted on these inviting targets and poured hundreds of shells into the packed boxcars. Russian soldiers could be seen cartwheeling into the air and falling into the snow. German batteries lined up the T-34s, which began to blaze, and suddenly there was a chance to seal the southern attack. 29th Division Commander Ernst Leiser seemed to understand the prescience of the moment and prepared to annihilate the burning enemy force south of Beketovka. But as he began to do so, another order reached him from Army Group B, more than 200 miles away in Starobelsk, to pull back and guard the 6th Army's rear at the Don. In the fading light of the 21st November, Leiser reluctantly broke contact and his division drove off northwest. By now, the remaining 6th Army had virtually disintegrated, and the 6th Romanian Cavalry Regiment was all that was left between the southern armored thrust and the Don River. Without being overly dramatic, it's true to say that with more daring, Paulus could have changed history. It's clear to military experts that if Leiser had been supported in his drive, the Russian attack would have faltered, as he was smashing the lower arm of the encirclement. News of the bloody defeat of the Russian 13th Corps filtered back to General Viktor Volsky's 4th Tank Corps, and now the Russian general faltered. He was aiming for Kalach, but he slowed his force, worried he'd be next. The cautious officer refused to go further without reinforcements. He needn't have worried. Leiser and the 29th had already left, following Army Group B's orders. 1,300 miles west of this unfolding tragedy, the Führer had been briefed. General Paulus naturally asked for permission to withdraw from Stalingrad to better defensive positions. Instead, Hitler sent this. Radio message number 1352, top secret, urgent, to HQ 6th Army, 21st November 42, 1525 hours German time. Führer order. 6th Army will hold positions despite threat of temporary encirclement. Keep railway line open as long as possible. Special orders regarding air supply will follow! Dictators tend to use uppercase and exclamation marks in their messages, as though shouting about something makes it the truth. Hitler had lost sight of what the truth in military matters meant, and his 6th Army was going to pay in blood. The implications of this order were stunning to consider, and while Paulus and Schmidt pondered the message, they received a phone call from 8th Air Corps Lieutenant General Martin Fiebig. He wanted to know how things were going at that critical bridge at Kalach. This was another important moment, as some German officers realized that the logistics of the entire sector hinged on control of Kalach. Schmidt said he saw no immediate danger and that the commander-in-chief was thinking of forming a hedgehog defense. "And how do you propose to keep the army supplied?" asked Fiebig. "That will have to be done from the air," said Schmidt. Fiebig was astonished. "A whole army? It's quite impossible. I advise you not to be so optimistic." Fiebig hung up and called his chief, General Richthofen, who then phoned Albert Jeskonek, who was Hermann Göring's deputy. Richthofen, as usual, had a full go. "You've got to stop it," he raged. "In the filthy weather we have here, and there's not a hope of supplying an army of 250,000 men from the air, it's stark, staring madness." Of course, he was 100% correct. Richthofen, for all his blunt rudeness, was no fool. He was outraged that men sitting in the warmth of their heated rooms over 1,000 miles away were pushing the men at the Stalingrad front around like little chess pieces. At about the same time as the southern assault began to the north, Kravchenko's 4th Tank Corps was already 25 miles deep into the German rear beyond Strecker's 11th Corps. Then suddenly, Kravchenko switched from advancing southwest to southeast, aiming at Kalach. And Strecker had a big problem. The Russian 3rd Guards Cavalry Corps had started to attack the 11th Corps from behind, in other words, directly from the west. The Germans here were trying to establish a defense line from the Greater Don Bend to protect the open gap behind the 6th Army. Strecker's 11th Corps was also facing the Soviet 65th Army, which kept up the pressure, making it impossible for his men to maintain the gap. They were being encircled. The Romanians ceased to be an army around this point. The German 376th Division had to pull around to face westwards, at the same time desperately trying to make contact with the 14th Panzer Division to the south. The Austrian 44th Infantry Division also deployed, but left behind most of their heavy equipment. For the days of the 20th and 21st November, teams of Russian tanks roamed the White Steppe, shooting into headquarters, detachments, supply dumps, communication centers, then pulling back into the mist to strike again miles away. Their tactics confused and demoralized the Germans still further. Radio reports were flooding into Golubinka, the Cossack village where General Paulus had set up his HQ. First reports from the south said the Russians were 40 miles south of the Don, then 50 miles southeast of the Don, and then, in fact, they were everywhere. Hysteria began to mark the voices on the radio as they begged the 6th Army for reinforcements and advice. Paulus and his sidekick Schmidt had none because they didn't know what was going on. German discipline broke down in this bedlam, and soldiers became sullen. Some ignored their commanding officer's orders. 12 miles north of Kalach was Golubinsky. The German maps tracking the attackers began to reveal what the Russians were hoping to achieve, to reach the all-important bridge across the Don at Kalach and to trap the 6th Army. During the course of the morning of the 21st, Paulus began to receive another series of nasty shocks. Different signals pointed to the same conclusion. Army Group B warned that the southern flank was now threatened from both sides. Paulus himself was now in danger. 6th Army's repair and maintenance bases were directly in the firing line, and worse, they had no defenses. Both Paulus and Schmidt realized in a chilling moment that the Russians were aiming at full encirclement and that the target was Kalach and the vital bridge. By midday, Paulus sent most of his staff eastwards to the railway junction at Gumrak, only 8 miles from Stalingrad. They set fire to all their files and buildings. Their general would follow later. Paulus and Schmidt then flew in 2 fuselage torch light planes to Nizhny Cheskaya, where they planned to join General Huth for a conference on the following day. At the same time, the Germans based at Kalach had little inkling of what was in store for them. 3 Soviet tank corps were on their way, and it was one of the most vulnerable points in the German defense. There was little organization with an ill-sorted collection of subunits and a small detachment of Feldgendarmerie and a Luftwaffe anti-aircraft battery. They heard about the Russians breaking through the Romanians to the north and heading towards their sector. Then later on the 21st, they heard about the breakthrough south of Stalingrad. They had no idea that Volsky's mechanized corps was on the move again and approaching 4th Panzer Army's former headquarters only 30 miles to their southeast. The defenses at Kalach were not only inadequate, they were badly managed. On the west bank, on the heights above the Don River, there were four Luftwaffe flank emplacements and two anti-aircraft guns on the east bank. Only a group of 25 men were assigned to secure the bridge, and a scratch battalion of rear troops remained in the town on the east bank. Major General Rodin, who commanded the Russian 26th Tank Corps, had given the order to take the Kalach Bridge to Lieutenant Colonel Filipov, who led the 19th Tank Brigade. It was early morning when Filipov's column arrived at Kalach from the west. At 6:15, they captured two German tanks and a reconnaissance vehicle. Switching off the lights, they drove these vehicles to the temporary bridge across the Don and opened fire on the guards. 16 more T-34s drove into the thick scrub on the heights of the river to protect the Russian attack. The Germans knocked out several of these, but it was too late. The Russians disabled the explosive charges set to blow up the bridge. Russian motorized infantry then arrived, along with artillery and mortars, and by mid-morning they had broken into the town. There was chaos in the streets as the Germans ran out of ammunition, particularly for their artillery. On the 22nd, the way was open for the Russians to link up the 4th and 26th Tank Corps coming from the northern flank and Volsky's 4th Mechanized Corps moving to Kalach from the south of Stalingrad. Guided towards each other by green signal flares fired at intervals, the Russian spearheads met in the open steppe, ironically near the village of Sovietsky. With bear hug embraces, a scene which was reenacted at a later date for Soviet propaganda and filmed. What wasn't filmed was the exchange of vodka that took place on the 22nd. Drinking while fighting was not exactly an esteemed virtue. News of the Russian armies joining up behind their lines spread rapidly on the German side, with soldiers shouting, "We are surrounded! We are surrounded!" Sunday, 22nd November, was also the Protestant Day of Remembrance for the Dead. "A somber Totensonntag, 1942, wrote Kurt Räuber, a priest serving as a doctor with the 16th Panzer Division. "Worry, fear, and horror." Some German Lanzers were not overly concerned. They had been surrounded the previous winter, and reinforcements had broken them out. But senior officers knew the truth. This time, there were no reinforcements. And 40 miles to the west of Stalingrad, and ironically, the last pocket of resistance was coming from the Romanians. There, General Lascar had rejected the Red Army's demand for surrender, sending a note which read, "We will continue to fight without thought of surrender," he declared. But his troops, who were fighting hard, were running out of food and ammunition. It was going to be death for Lascar, not glory. The stories of men fighting against overwhelming odds would be repeated in the following days. The German 11th Army Corps was in grave danger. It had been fighting a defensive battle on three sides amidst this chaos and was finally overrun. During the retreat, German infantry divisions found themselves in the open fighting of cavalry attacks, like it was 1870, as one officer put it. And of course, their greatest problem was transport, mainly because of the shortage of horses. Remember that decision to move most of the livestock west of the Don away from Stalingrad. In some cases, the Germans used Russian prisoners in their dozens to pull their heavy trailers loaded with food and ammunition. One group of more than 100 prisoners pulled carts for 4 days almost non-stop, with the Feldwebels shooting anyone who appeared tired. Then they left the rest of the Russians on the steppe. Of the 96 huddled in the snow, two survived. The Russians who found them took pictures and accused the German command of a war crime. But of course, the Russians were arbitrarily shooting German prisoners and mistreating them terribly at the same time. The retreat by the Germans eastwards towards Stalingrad is thought of, in some ways, as worse than Napoleon's retreat from Moscow. The 16th Panzer Division had tried to attack Russian divisions, but had to turn back to the city. Men walked in snowstorms, the powdery snow whipped up by the wind lashing their faces. They had frostbite, no food. Only very few had proper winter uniforms. The Führer had let them down once again, and they marched with blankets rolled around their necks and paper shoes. Closer to the bridges over the Don, anarchy broke out, fighting. There were solid traffic jams of trucks, staff cars and dispatch riders, farm carts and field guns towed by the horses that could be harnessed. Russian tanks would appear out of the mist, gun down retreating soldiers and blow up their vehicles, then disappear. The myth of Romanian cowardice began to spread, and more fights broke out between the Germans and their former allies. The wounded were left lying where they were, and triage was straightforward. Head and stomach wounds placed on one side to die, and limbs amputated instead of bandaged. It was a nightmare of ghoulish proportions as the bloody mess of Operation Uranus gained intensity. On the 24th of November, Hitler sent a drastic message to the 6th Army at 0800 hours 38 under the highest priority heading Führerbefehl, which read, 6th Army will adopt hedgehog defense. Present Volga Front and Northern Front to be held at all costs. Supplies coming by air. After 2 days of frantic communication between him and Paulus, Hitler had delivered an incredible verdict. He denied Paulus of any freedom of movement or initiative. Paulus, who'd been planning a breakout with his fellow officers, now cancelled it, despite strong prompting that he should ignore Hitler and save his men. The German OKW knew that Paulus needed emergency support. So Field Marshal Erich von Manstein was appointed commander of the newly formed Army Group Don while he sat at Army Headquarters 280 miles west of Moscow. Manstein was in charge of the encircled 6th Army, Papa Hoth's battered 4th Panzer Army, and the remnants of the Romanian divisions scattered across the steppe. By the 25th of November, some Germans were committing suicide as the torture of this retreat proved too much. On that day, the temperature dropped drastically just to compound the pain, but there was some optimism by officers and troops because it was then that they heard that Manstein would try and relieve the 6th Army from the west. Manstein is coming, went the shouts along the frozen bulkers in the Kessel or cauldron between the Don and Volga rivers. The genius who'd outflanked the Maginot Line to take France in 6 weeks, who'd crushed the Russian defenders at the Crimean fortress city of Sebastopol in a few days, was on his way to Stalingrad. The white knight of fascism was going to save the day. By the 26th of November, the Don had frozen solid in places and the Red Army began to cross over the ice near Preskovatka, tightening their grip west of Stalingrad. This would be very bad news for Paulus, and sitting in his bunker at 62nd Army Headquarters in Stalingrad, General Choikov now knew he was no longer fighting a lonely battle on the west bank of the Volga. The initiative had shifted to the Russians. From now on, Hitler would have very few cards to play, and he would begin paying for Operation Barbarossa. We must halt at this point. Next episode, we'll hear about the Germans' attempts at a breakout, or to be more accurate, a break-in at Stalingrad, as Goering's air transport theory cracked. A quick thanks to wonderful words of support from David in Boston. Your comments made my day. Thank you, too, for rounding up your Twitter followers. Much obliged. Please rate the podcast on iTunes if you have the inclination. If you want to contact me, head to my website, abwarpodcast.com, or direct message me on Twitter, @DesLatham. Until next week, goodbye.